Okay. Good morning, everybody. Good morning in Australia, or good afternoon, or good evening.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good night.
Thank you for joining us early in the morning here. You're going to give us a presentation on a very uplifting presentation, I must say, about the effectiveness of financial reporting. I'll leave it to Chris to introduce you.
Okay, so thank you, Hans. And firstly, I'd like to introduce our two speakers this morning. So we have Professor Michael Deverne, who's on the... whatever that side is. And he's the chair of Accounting and Business Information Systems in the Faculty of Business and Economics at the University of Melbourne. And on the other side, we have Dr. Dean Hanlon, who's a senior lecturer in the Department of Accounting at Monash University. Now, these two gentlemen did a fantastic job for us, and they presented this paper at our research forum last year, and Sue was very kindly a participant at that forum. So we thought you would be very interested in the results that came out of this research, given all of the comments that we find about the fact that financial statements don't actually provide any useful information. This, at least, as Hans said, does provide an update that's a little bit more positive than that. So with that introduction, I'll pass it over to the gentleman in Australia.
He's
going to
start us off.
Thank you. Firstly, I'd just like to thank members of the IASB and members of ASAP for the opportunity to present our findings. The aim of today's presentation is to summarise key findings from our research project, which says whether financial reporting is still an effective tool for equity investors in Australia. In particular, we focus on whether, how and why financial reporting is decision useful. So obviously, myself and Michael are involved in the project. There are a couple of other project members as well, Professor Matt Pinnick and Mr. Cole Giles, both from the University of Melbourne. So I'll just direct you as to when to perhaps turn over slides. So if you can move away from the first slide and have a look at the second slide, which is by way of introduction. Our study is motivated by criticism regarding the decision use of financial reporting. And also the conflicting international evidence, particularly across Europe and the United States, as to whether financial reporting is still relevant to equity investors. So in particular, we had two research questions, as you can see on the slide. First research question focused on relevant key accounting amounts within primary financial statements, in particular reported net income, shareholders' equity and operating cash flows, while the second research question focuses on the relevance to equity investors of non-GAAP accounting information as proxied by EBITDA and EBIT. So in order to answer these research questions, we undertake a mixed approach. Our first approach is archival analysis, where our archival analysis informs whether the extent to which accounting information is incorporated to share prices. Based on our archival analysis, our sample period, as you can see from the slide, runs from 1992 to 2015, and we gather data for 29,838 firm year observations. Part of our analysis relates to our field interview methodology, where our field interviews will provide us with evidence on how and why accounting information is used for investment purposes. As part of the interview process, we conducted 17 interviews with investors, regulators and practitioners across giving rise to 107 pages of transcripts. So, turning over on to the next slide, research contains a number of findings and they were documented in the research paper that we distributed. One of the key findings that we want to focus on is the comparative relevance to equity investors of net income, which is a statutory profit measure, and non-GAAP earnings measured by EBITDA and EBIT. I see EBITDA and EBIT as non-GAAP, which is consistent with some of the terminology which has been used elsewhere including IOSCO. As you can see from the graph, what the archival evidence indicates is that on average, EBIT is better able to explain company share prices than net income over our sample period, and that EBITDA is superior to both EBIT and net income explaining company share prices. But looking more specifically at the graph, on average, you can see that a company's EBITDA, EBIT, and net income associated with 57, 54, and 52% of the company's share price, respectively. One other thing which you can also gather from the graph is that there's a comparable trend in the relevance of EBITDA, EBIT, and net income over the sample period. And is that to conclude, or it tends to suggest that investors view these alternative performance metrics as complements rather than as substitutes. Turning over the page where we look at the interview evidence in relation to the IFRS time gap, I'll hand over to Michael.
Thanks, Dean. So, the purpose of the interviews is really to try and understand the how and the why of what is going on. We see the statistical relationships. How are investors actually making use of that information? And what was really pleasing to me, seeing the results statistically, that the information seems to correlate to share price. When we start to talk to investors, we see some nuances from that. So first and foremost, there's a confirmatory role for the financial statements, and they are giving them a reliable information that helps them understand future performance. The reliability and credibility of the information is crucial here. This is what they really value as the input to their valuation models. So they're looking for something that they can draw projections into the future value from, rather than relying on the financials to give them a valuation of the company, which is consistent with the way things are framed in the conceptual framework of giving them information to valuation rather than trying to value. So even though the historical data sometimes is, you know, historical cost information, which may not be as relevant, the reliability is something they cling to very much as a means of entering into their own valuation models, which is their source of intellectual property, but what they're selling in the marketplace to move forward. The conventional financial information is really crucial to them as that foundation for their whole process. The non-GAAP information is also useful for them because there are nuances around the industry and specific companies that can't be easily captured by a standardised reporting approach. And so what we found was there were a number of different non-GAAP metrics in specific industries that investors were looking to better understand what those financial results were and project for the future, and turn to using that to communicate a broader of what's happening in business. The interesting feedback we then got from the interview data was that while those measures were useful, there's the lack of standardisation there, lack of transparency means they recognise this is information that management can massage, present in more favourable ways. And so they are a lot more sceptical about that information. So it then goes back to the financial statements saying that liability and that credibility as the foundation of the whole valuation process the investor is going on.
Thank you. So we can then turn over to some additional archival analysis, which we have to put in our archival analysis also includes distribution of change in the combined evidence of chief and shareholders' equity of firms classified by primarily motivated by the assertion that due to an increased number of service-orientated firms, corresponding increase in investment in assets, that financial reporting is declining in relevance. If that was the case, then you would expect to see a decline in relevance of financial reporting over time, particularly amongst tangible intensive industries. So as part of our analysis, what we did is we did our sample period, and we divided it into two sub-periods, prior pre-2000, which is indicated by the yellow bars in the graph, and then post-2000, which is indicated in the bar. And we chose 2000 as the, at that point in time, because it seems to correspond to the drop in investing in tangible assets in Australia. So what we can see is looking at our graph is that other than stable firms in the energy or the financial sectors, the net shareholders' equity has stayed constant or increased across the two times. In five of the eight industries, we saw an increase in the relevance of financial reporting post-2000. But I guess what's most interesting is that the industries that experienced the most dramatic increase in financial reporting relevance post-2000 were in intangible-intensive industries, such as the telecommunications and the information technology industries. You can see, therefore, telecommunications. We have a look at from 1992 to 1999, as indicated by the yellow bar, reported net income and shareholders' equity explained on average 34% of the company's share price for those who are within that industry. Now, post-2000, as indicated by the purple bar, reported net income and shareholders' equity explained on average 66% of the company's share price for those firms in that industry. That indicates there has been an increase in the relevance of financial support across time, firms within the telecommunications. Similar results for the information technology industry, where pre-2000, indicated by the yellow bar, reported net income and shareholders' equity explained on average 37% of company share prices, firms within that industry. Then post-2000, that increased to 50%. So I guess overall, these results seem to indicate that financial reporting still remains relevant even amongst intangible industries. Moving over, as part of our final additional archival analysis, what we did is we partitioned sample firms into size quartiles so as to ascertain whether the financial reports of different size companies are similarly relevant to equity investors. So as you can see, we've got different lines there as part of the line graph. First indicating the largest quartile of sample firms, the green line indicating the second largest, and the red dotted line indicating the third largest or the second smallest. So as you can see from that graph, net income and shareholders' equity is reported by the top 75% of sample firm size. They remain consistently relevant to equity investors over the sample period. But I guess what you also can see is that for the smallest portfolio of firms, there appears to be a downward trend in the relevance of net income and shareholders' equity in more recent times. We attribute that more so to the fact that share prices may be a noisy measure for those small cap firms. So rather than perhaps reflecting a deterioration in the relevance of financial reporting, it's actually a disconnection between the company's share price and their performance as indicated by information. So I guess finally, just looking at the research implications, our research provides evidence that financial reporting is still an effective tool for investors. Our archival evidence indicates that annual financial statements are relevant in explaining company share prices, while our interview-based evidence indicates that annual financial statements are an important input in the investment valuation model. We also find that financial reports play a confirmatory role in investment decision-making, and that financial statements, while they're necessary, they're not sufficient for investors. And they need to be complemented with non-GAAP financial information to complement the statutory financial and the statutory information. So we believe that this finding is of interest to the IASB in particular, and their communication in financial reporting between approaches. What we think is that our findings inform whether the inclusion of a additional subtotal, such as EBIT, in statement of financial performance, that can prove to be decision useful to financial business users, including equity investors. So but this is all in the context of our formal presentation, but so we're happy to answer any questions you may have even from either slides of the research paper that we've done.
Well, thank you very much for this very interesting presentation. What you concluded is, of course, what we have always been saying, but it is very reassuring to know that it is actually true. But my first question would be, can you explain, perhaps methodologically, why the outcome of your research is so vastly different from that of Professor Baruch Lev, except for perhaps his wish to sell as many books as possible.
So we've been looking at that. One of the things that we've been asked to isolate, we thought, is this the intangibles was part of the issue? Methodologically, we've taken the same approach. We've just got different data because we've got Australian data versus the US data. One of the interesting things in that setup is the US has the quarterly reporting environment. We don't have mandated quarterly reporting, which means that your annual financial statements in the US context, you have less surprise in those because you've had three quarters of information getting revealed to you, whereas in Australia, the annual financial statements have more surprise in that you haven't had that reliable information released to you on a quarterly basis to the same extent. So that changes the value of that. And so I think, with all due respect to Baruch, and I was on the faculty at NYU, and so was a colleague of mine, I think it's a misinterpretation to say that that's the relevance of the accounting information. I think it has more to do with the reporting frequency than anything else. And it's not surprisingly about the intangibles, because our industry data shows that it's not about the intangibles.
Interesting. So the fact that there is no obligation of quarterly reporting in Australia means that actually a lot of companies do not do it.
Well, it also has a different position in the way that it's looked at, because you're not having that as a statutory requirement. You're not going to be getting the auditors looking at that closely in anything that it's disclosed there. And what we're seeing from the interview data and the way that people are using the accounting information, it's about having that as the reliable starting point for their analysis.
I see.
They recognise all the limitations, but it's a number that they can trust to start with. Anything they get from management is informative, but they have to be sceptical about it because of the bias. So this gives them the foundation that they can then incorporate information.
Sorry, might just be useful. So in Australia, rather than having quarterly reporting, there's a continuous disclosure obligation. So if something significant has happened that you expect would move the market price, then you're meant to actually disclose it to the market, but it's not that quarterly reporting. Okay. So it's just a...
All right, any other questions?
I had a question. Yes. You pointed out the trend with respect to telecommunications and information technology, that they seem to have increased pretty substantially. Why do you suppose that is? That was the one where I would have expected the opposite.
We did discuss this. We were sort of saying, I don't want to show this graph because I don't have a good answer to that. We're really surprised about that one. Yeah, we're at a loss a little bit on that, but that's something we're still trying to explore to understand. Because it doesn't make sense immediately.
I was going to suggest, I think one of the things to look at would be business acquisitions, to see whether or not that's... because there was a bit of a merger in that industry, and whether or not because of the business acquisition accounting you actually end up with more assets on balance sheet would be one of the things that I would have a look at.
I'll now give the floor to Nick Anderson, one of our board members who engaged in a public debate with Professor Baruch Lev. he's your biggest fan.
And survive and tell the story as well. So thank you very much for the presentation and for the research, which I read with interest. I guess in terms of Lev's work, he does concentrate a lot more around performance of share prices when results are announced, as you say, and I took issue with that. One thing that struck a chord with me in terms of how I used to work as an investor and how I find other investors work is that the totality of the financial statements is what counts. Rather than one statement in particular, it's the interplay between the statements which is very important. The one little bit that perhaps I was trying to rationalise is why cash flow doesn't come out better than perhaps I'd expect in terms of its relevance. And I know you focused there on operating cash flow as a measure. And I was trying to think about, to rationalise that. And I go back to my own way of working. I don't remember ever screening on operating cash flow per se, but I might have screened on operating cash flow less CapEx as a measure. And I wonder whether that might give more relevance than just operating cash flow.
Mm-hmm. That's something certainly we'll look at archivally. Interestingly, in the interview data, we were surprised that the cash flow statement wasn't a major driver of it, of their analysis. And as you say, it was an integrated view of all the reports together. And a lot of people saying you couldn't separate those out just by design of things, but also the desire on the investors to develop their own predictions about what cash flow was and work back from the numbers rather than rely on the interpretation in the cash flow statement itself. We went in with the expectation that, they're going to talk a lot about the cash flow statement, and it was very surprising how little it was talked about by investors. A little bit more by the practitioners and the regulators who seem to think that it's something more to play, but the investors hardly mentioned the cash flow statement. They were interested in cash flow, but they were not driving that from the cash flow statement itself.
Patrick de Cambourg, French Standard Setter.
Thank you for this very interesting study. could you help me clarify two points? The first one, in the financial sector, do you include banks and insurance companies or only banks? Do you know?
We include both, banks and insurance.
Okay, thank you. And the other point, which is more bearing in mind that the concept of OCI is a relatively new concept and your period is a very extended period, net profit after taxation, the one that you have taken into account, and as a consequence, EBIT and EBITDA are not taking into account OCI, or am I mistaken?
No, they're not.
We've got to work with what data we've got available back to the time series, otherwise we can lose comparability if there's differences in that data. That was the other reason why, while we're interested in non-GAAP, we had to use things like EBITDA as the proxies for that, because the measures that you're going to get that are actually used as non-GAAP measures, there's too much variability in yet consistency.
Thank you.
Yukio Ono from Japan.
Thank you for your time and effort to put into this presentation. My understanding is that this presentation provides the evidence on the relevance of earnings or net profit after tax and not on the comprehensive income. I think this presentation suggests that the IASB should focus on improving the information provided within the financial statement and not on non-GAAP information or information outside the financial statement. Is my understanding right?
We did ask our interview participants a lot about would they want regulation around the non-GAAP numbers. And a lot of the non-GAAP information that they found valuable was the industry-specific sort of measures. So in certain industries, there are standard measures. So if you're in the airline industry, it's your load factor, for example, is an important measure that you might be wanting to report on. So they don't want to see too much regulation on that, but they are aware that you lose that transparency. With respect to getting into the particulars of EBITDA versus comprehensive income, etc., just be careful, because remember, when we're looking at the archive, we're looking at correlational data. So it's a little hard to extract out some of the elements too far when we're looking at that from a correlational perspective, because what causal connection is, and that's why we went with the interviews to try and establish what the reasoning as to why the numbers were the way they were.
And I think also just to clarify that EBIT and EBITDA is your calculation of those rather than they weren't necessarily what the companies themselves...
Exactly. That was not reported EBIT and EBITDA. That was something we calculated from the financial devices that had the information there. Exactly.
Okay.
So we had consistency in calculation of that number across the time period.
That is very interesting, because we are making great efforts to sort of define EBIT and not EBITDA yet, but EBIT. We find that very difficult, but we
standardized. It's standardized.
We have found a principle-based solution for it, hopefully. So I encourage you to look at the discussion paper that we're going to produce, and you might want to give us your share your experience with us and see if your definition is very different from what we have come up with.
Consultation document.
Corrected by my vice chair. Okay. Any other rebellious comments? Yeah. You? Yu Chen from China.
Thank you for this interesting study. I just would like to share with all of you some findings in China. Before this meeting, we seek comments from some academic researchers in university, and they provide some very interesting findings. In recent years, some academics in China, they have conducted similar empirical research on this issue, and they provide some high-level summarized findings. Generally speaking, the annual financial report information is relevant to the investment decision made by equity investors in China. This is the first point. Second, for the chain, they found that from 1990 to present, the usefulness of financial information for equity investor has been increased. And the P&L of the listed company is more relevant than the operating cash flow. And but both the P&L and the operating cash flow are relevant to the investor decision making. And the last point is about the non-financial information. They did some research on the information provided in the MD&A, for example, some forward-looking information. They found that very interesting that in the very beginning, this kind of information has no decision-making relevance to the investors. But with the increase of the ability of investors and the non-financial information became more and more high quality, and they found that the relevance became increased. So that's our findings. Thank you.
Thank you. Very interesting. I think part of what we're seeing there is this whole value of the quality and reliability of the information is what the investor is really expecting to see coming from accounting. So even in the MD&A that you're describing there, as the quality and reliability of that improves, then it becomes more relevant. So I think that's what we see investors really prizing, is give me a reliable, dependable foundation from which I can calculate my own approach to the valuation of that entity. That seems to be where we're able to provide the information in a standardized way.
Tom, did you want to ask something?
No, sorry.
Oh, okay. Any other questions or comments?
One thing you might quickly want to just mention, Michael, there were some interesting results from the interviews in terms of segment reporting.
Yes. So this was not something we specifically asked. So part of the procedures with the interviews is you ask very open-ended questions and move down to more defined questions. One of the questions we were asking is, what other information would you be interested in seeing to help you make investment decisions? And consistently, segment reporting came out as an issue. And what we found interesting about that was the approach of segment reporting where you report segments based on the way the business is managed is problematic because that can change from year to year and impact comparability. And what they were really wanting to see was essentially a product line-based segment and a geography-based segment so that they can understand what the underlying business model is, what the risk exposure is to the marketplaces that the entity is operating in. And so that sort of information they saw as really valuable because it helped them make that projection of what the key objective for them is trying to get an handle on this persistent future earnings. So what's the earnings going to be into the future? How much is that going to persist into the future? And that improved segment reporting where we did get both the product and their job allows them to do a much better sensitivity analysis as they project into that future and come up with their valuations from that. And that was something that was unsolicited. Every investor interviewer bar one unsolicited brought that up as a as an issue when we raised it at the very end with that one who had an email, he was very keen to see it as well. So it was really interesting that come from them as a way of really getting a handle on the business model that the entity was employing was part of what they were trying to capture with that.
Okay. Perhaps not entirely surprising, but yeah. We hear that a lot from investors too. Okay. Well, thank you so much for your brief but very incisive and interesting presentation. And it was, of course, a piece of news that we were glad to hear, and especially since it was very well researched. Thank you so much.
And, thank you very much.
And let's keep in touch. Thank you.
Thank you.